would inevitably sigh and mutter, "Boys," under her breath. But Paige, their firstborn, had been quieter even then. She would sit on a bench with a coloring book and intact crayons. She didn't like it when a crayon broke or the wrapper came off, and always, in an ironic metaphor, stayed within the lines. As she grew older, 15, 16, 17, Paige would sit on a bench, just as Simon was doing now, and write stories and song lyrics in a notebook her father had bought her at the Papyrus on Columbus Avenue. But Paige wouldn't sit on just any bench. Something like 4,000 Central Park benches had been adopted via big money donations. Personalized plaques were installed on the benches, most of them simple memorials like the one Simon now sat on, which read, "In memory of Carl and Corky." Others, the ones Paige gravitated toward, told little stories. For C and B, who survived the Holocaust and began a life in this city. "To my sweetie Anne, I love you, I adore you, I cherish you. Will you marry me?" This spot is where our love story began on April 12, 1942. The bench that Paige most preferred, the one she'd sit on for hours on end with her latest notebook, and maybe this was an early indicator, memorialized a mysterious tragedy. "To beautiful Merrill, age 19. You deserved so much better and died so young. I would have done anything to save you." Paige would move from bench to bench, read the inscriptions, find one to use as a story prompt. Simon, in an attempt to bond, tried to do that too, but he didn't have his daughter's imagination. Still, he sat with his newspaper or fiddled with his phone, checking the markets or reading the business news as Paige's pen moved in a flurry. What happened to those old notebooks? Where were they now? Simon had no idea. Penny Lane mercifully came to an end, and the singer Panhandler segued right into "All You Need Is Love." A young couple sat on the bench next to Simon. The young man stage whispered, "Can I give her money to shut up?" To which his female companion snickered, "It's like John Lennon is being killed all over again." A few people dropped some coins into the woman's guitar case, but most people stayed clear or backed away, making a face that indicated they had gotten a whiff of something of which they wanted no part. But Simon listened and listened hard, hoping to find some semblance of beauty in the melody, in the song, in the lyrics, in the performance. He barely noticed the tourists or their tour guides, or the man who wore no shirt but should, selling water bottles for a dollar, or the skinny guy with the soul patch who told a joke for a dollar, "Special, 6 jokes for $5. Or the old Asian woman burning incense to honor John Lennon in some vague way, or the joggers, the dog walkers, the sunbathers. But there was no beauty in the music. None. Simon's eyes stayed locked on the panhandling girl mangling John Lennon's legacy. Her hair was matted clumps. Her cheekbones were sunken. The girl was rail thin, raggedy, dirty, damaged, homeless, lost. She was also Simon's daughter, Paige. Simon had not seen Paige in 6 months, not since she had done the inexcusable. It had been the final break for Ingrid. "You leave her be this time," Ingrid had told him after Paige ran out. Meaning? And then Ingrid, a wonderful mother, a caring pediatrician, who dedicated her life to helping children in need, said, "I don't want her back in this house." "You don't mean that." "I do, Simon. God help me, I do." For months, without Ingrid's knowledge, he'd searched for Paige. Sometimes his attempts were well organized, like when he hired the private investigator. More often his efforts were hit and miss, haphazard, consisting of walking through dangerous drug-infested areas, flashing her photograph to the stoned and unsavory. He'd come up with nothing. Simon had wondered whether Paige, who had recently celebrated her birthday, how, Simon wondered, a party, a cake, drugs? Did she even know what day it was? Had left Manhattan and gone back to that college town where it all began.